everybody. Welcome to Beyond the Norm, episode 8, where we talk all things comedy and entertainment related and how that stuff works. So usually I kick this off. There's three metrics that I use kind of to judge what I'm doing or why I might try to attempt something. Number one, does it make me, does it make me or my companies whatever money? Do I love it? Or am I intellectually curious about it? It's got to hit one of those things for me to figure out if I'm going to devote my time or whatever to it. So I usually go over some of that. So on the business side of things, we landed or rebooked a gig, actually a huge gig that we did last year with GameStop. So last year we worked with GameStop. That's a retail gaming company or retail video game sales company, whatever, but huge. And we did biggest event that Improv Asylum's ever done. We had to fly 29 people out to Las Vegas for a week where we trained over 4,000 of their people. So
I feel like for the amount of people who went and for the type of people who went, pretty good like return, like in terms of like you're putting comedians in the belly of the beast to like fuck everything up.
Well, look, it's when you work in this industry and what we do, from a producer or director standpoint, especially the larger it gets, you're just trying to get these very talented and creative people to just keep their shit together just long enough to and I will give everybody on that gig, like you could see it in their eyes. Some of them are going so against their instincts, which is just like, got to keep it together. And it was the hardest gig. It was the hardest corporate gig I've ever been a part of. And I think most people would say that. Oh, yeah. And then true to form, as soon as the gig was over, people lost their shit. I don't think Kelly Dooley got back for like 4 days. she got stuck in Arizona.
For her birthday.
Yeah.
She was alone in Phoenix on her birthday.
It's a beautiful indie movie moment when she tells the story. Like, oh, I can't wait until I see this in Sundance. And it's going to really crush.
And Teddy went on a tear. Like, Teddy and I were kind of like playing, some games together. And then I was like, oh, man, it's so late. We should go to bed because we got to get up early to catch the flight. He's like, yeah, let's go. And we go off. I went to bed, and he just like, oh, I'm going to go get a smoke. He went right back to the table, made a bunch more money, and then missed his flight and used all of his winnings change his flight. So he left with nothing.
There must be some kind of formula, but as you elongate the time that the performers have to keep their stuff together, like there's a diminishing return on investment on something bad happening.
Yeah.
So there can only be so much. But to that end, we did a good enough job because they hired us again.
That's great.
So bring us back. Yeah. And so
bunch
now,
of charming folks, yeah.
Oh, man, that was it's a tricky group. And we're going back this year. It's in
Indianapolis.
What a high and a low. GameStop.
But it's pretty neat, though, in terms of the fact that, companies like that, they really did see the value of it, which, as much as I, know and believe what we do, there's always that sense of like, well, does this translate or does a client do that, or does it translate with the client? And they actually gave us feedback, and they're like, well, since that training, we've done our metrics, and a certain percentage of sales has gone up that they somehow directly can relate back to what we did, and their engagement of their managers to their client. Like they have all these things, and they're like, oh, okay. So they're telling us that it worked,
yeah,
as opposed to, so it's pretty neat. So that's coming up. That's for the kind of money making thing. The love it side of things, I'm knee deep in softball season. So that's kind of, it's probably repeating myself a couple of different times. But the love it factor is the opportunity to work with the kids and these girls. And I've been working with them for many years. And I love it so much. And it's funny because clearly I love it way more than the kids do, right? I mean, every coach will say that.
Yeah.
Like, and there are a couple other, I have another man and a woman, a father and a mom that are on the team as well. And, I say, I'm like, yeah. I'm like, we love the board of you guys. I get it. But it's that opportunity to, from a director or a leadership standpoint, to figure out how do you teach, but how do you do it in a positive way? Because that's one of the things that I see that just I hate and it blows my mind. But the amount still to this day of negative coaching that goes on. And it doesn't mean you have to be soft. You guys know that I'm not overly soft, but that doesn't mean you can't be very positive. So I love it. I love the ability to, because it's softball, there's so much downtime. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of shit that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Like, you gotta be social, so it's pretty fun.
That's why I play softball.
For the social aspect?
Yeah, I was like, I could not do any kind of sports, but I was like, I love hanging out with my friends.
Yeah, and you're on the bench.
Yeah, they cheers up. I would, like, intimidate the other team. Very fun.
That's what you want. That's great.
Oh, that's all you need.
And sadly, Grace broke the tip of her thumb last week, so we lost Grace.
From, like, a...
She was bunting, she had her hands wrong, and broke the tip of her thumb. Ooh, poor kid.
So it's like a... Was it, like, compound?
Yeah, like, it just crushed it. And, like, she's a tough kid. She's like, you know, she's like, no, I want to stay on the bench. And it was all, like, her nails hanging off. So bloody. And I'm like, and I told her, I'm like, Grace, I love it. You're tough, and I get it. But this is an injury.
Yeah.
Bringing it over to your mom, and you're going to the doctor. Yeah. Like, I like that you want to tough it out. I'm like, I love it. I'm like, but no, that's an injury. That's, you're not, you know. So that's great. So that's what we love. And then from an intellectual curiosity thing, I became friends with this gentleman. His name's Patrick Sweeney,
mm-hmm.
And he's known as the fear guru. And he's a great guy. He, you know, is an entrepreneur, sold his companies, but he's like an ex like Olympic athlete, and he like does mountain biking like excursions from the top of like base camp at Everest, and it's just crazy, right? Crazy other stuff. But his whole thing is all the science behind fear and how managing and pushing through that like also unleashes a world of what you can do. I think we as performers learn that to a degree, right? Pushing through our fear to be able to perform. But Patrick's a good guy. We ended up meeting because he reached out to me, and he was looking for some individual coaching for his own speaking gigs. And so I ended up working with him on that, and he's like, right. And I was like, well, hey, I tell you what, you're doing all kinds of stuff that I want to be doing from an adventuring standpoint. I'm like, why don't we get together? And it's kind of formed a friendship. But I've been very working and talking with him a lot about just kind of the idea of fear and risk and managing fear. And he's got a really fantastic story that I want to get him on this podcast. So, but it's really, he went from crippling fear of flying to he is now like an acrobatics pilot.
Oh, wow.
That's
like,
crazy.
So it's pretty amazing. So I've been kind of curious and looking at stuff like that. So with all that said, out of the way, you've heard another voice here, a very lovely voice.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, it's very nice.
The camera just looked right at me. It's not me. It's
all right, I think you have a lovely voice.
Oh, thank you so much. But it's, I think everybody here. There we go, Aaron. Now it's focused right on you.
Everybody sounds good. We have the lovely and talented Aaron Farrington, main stage actor here at Improv Asylum, mm-hmm. as my guest. Hello, Aaron.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm so good. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, we are thrilled to have you, Aaron, and you took your walk over, and you got your sunshine in your hair.
I do. I got sun stuff in my hair.
It's very great. So, you know, obviously Aaron is an actress here, and, you know, for me, how I approach this or... like I like to think a lot about, there's so much talk about the craft.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's always this gap in my mind that I've seen in doing this is then the other side of it, which is not necessarily the improvisation, but what people do to get where they're at.
Yeah.
The other stuff. Because at some point, you know, at the level that you're at,
mm-hmm.
you know, talent is assumed, right? I mean, and that's where I always say, like, when people go, you know, at some point, talent's assumed. You go to New York, you go to LA, you can't wonder why nobody's seeing your brilliance. We're all talented.
Yeah.
Right? That's assumed. So there needs to be that next step. So that's a lot of what we explore and what we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
What's kind of your journey from where you came from to where you're at now?
To where I came from?
Yeah, like how did you start in all of this in entertainment and comedy, and where did that start, and where and how did you get here?
Well, you know, I was a little chunky kid, mm-hmm. and just desperate for attention. So I did an improv class at a summer camp that I went to when I was 10 years old, and I was like, got it, found it, this is it, I'm gonna stick to this and never do anything else.
It's so but it is like so amazing when you find it. And
it could
be as a 10-year-old, it can be in college, it can be, but like I think there is that moment, mm-hmm. for everybody where you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, this is the thing. That, oh. Like, this is, no doubt, this is the thing.
Mm-hmm. And then I did it. I was lucky enough to go to a high school where we had a troupe.
And where was that?
I went to high school at Timberland Regional High School in Placid, New Hampshire. And we had a troupe that was, like, competitive, and it was, like, very popular because we had a kind of a nerdy, more arts-leaning school. And you couldn't audition until the end of your freshman year.
Oh.
Yeah, and I was one of two freshmen to get on.
Yeah.
60 people auditioned. Only three or four got on the team.
What was the name?
Milkman, baby.
Milkman.
Oh,
Milkman.
Yeah, you have that on your locker.
Yeah, I do. I have it on a sticker on my locker.
What's
now.
What's the slogan?
Comedy that delivers. It's so bad, but...
It's all bad, and that's why we're like, there's no good one. Like,
yeah.
And that's what makes it great, but like whenever you talk about historically the first things you're in, it's always
bad. Oh, it's always bad.
We'll give you more improv in a glass bottle every Monday.
That was like, it was such a unique experience because it was so cool at our school that... Like, my first shows doing improv were for, like, 150 people, like,
wow.
200 people. And we'd have, like, a show once a month. And we just thought we were the coolest. Like, we had T-shirts that you could buy. And, like, we had fans who bought our T-shirts in the school. And we're like, oh, we're so cool. And then I went to college at Suffolk. I went there because my mom was like... I Googled them. They have an improv troupe. She goes, you go there. They gave you a lot of money. Go there. They have an improv troupe. So I went there, and I went from going and performing for like 150 people who would like quote improv scenes back to me to going to performing at college for 20 drunk freshmen in the basement of a dorm. And you're like, oh gosh, this is
sure. Which is interesting because usually it's the other way around in that you're in college and you become that rock star in college and then you make the leap to your first kind of, you know, professional theater, and that's usually like, and that's when I went from being a rock star in college to 20 drunks in a basement.
Oh yeah, it's a big like boom, boom. But then the troupe that I was in college was really great. It was so awesome to be there. I wasn't a fan of Suffolk, because I was just like, ugh, all these classes are boring, all these people are stupid. But then I went to Seriously Ben, and I was like, oh, there's this group of people who are like so competitive and weird about comedy, just like me, and they are all so interesting, and I was just like, oh, this is it.
Well, full disclosure, so Improv Asylum works very closely with Seriously Ben, and over the years, you know, it's almost been a pipeline in the sense that you've had who's come from there, Dan Faniff and Trevor Livingston, Kelly Dooley, you,
Kevin
Rogers, John McGregor.
Yep, he got on the year I got on.
I don't think I knew that. So yeah. John McGregor, I mean, and that's just, you know, and then
there are, Zach Barker.
Zach was
Zach was on
K
before
too, right?
me.
Stephanie
K,
See, that's got Amanda Sousa.
Amanda Sousa,
she was there.
Yeah, and then there's even people before that I'm forgetting. So it's been quite a pipeline, and I think part of that too is because you've had that with Improv Asylum being involved, a certain amount of professional development that happens.
Oh, it's
there.
Definitely. It felt like a. I remember when I came here and I was like, "Wait a second, people are doing this, but they've been doing it for 4 years."
Yeah.
I was like, "How do you compete with this? You guys have been doing it, and now you're doing it again." I was like, "Oh shit, I'm way behind."
It did feel like such a cheat code because we did it in the style that felt very professional because we took it very seriously. And we're like, we're black and bling. Like, we're going to competitions. We're beating out the other people. And, like, all the other college troops were like, this is fun. We have baseball T-shirts on and we're living our best life. And we're like, move over. You're
move
not fast
over.
Enough.
We've got to
Your
go.
Edits are sloppy.
But I think it is because, you know, we always talk about it, which is, and I think you identified it for yourself very early, it sounds like even potentially in high school, the asylum, the way it's set up and even the aesthetic, it's geared towards people that want to do this for a living. And when I say this, I don't necessarily mean improvisation, but who want to make a career in entertainment and comedy in some way, shape, or form. And so that's the aesthetic and that's what you get. And for some people, that's way too much, you know, and it's not a qualification of talent or anything of that nature, but it is, no, that's who we are. And so therefore it's natural that it goes kind of down that path.
Yeah. I'm always more attracted to people who take it seriously and treat it very seriously, because it's already such a nerdy thing to do, like improv, and it can feel very like childish. But if you take it seriously and you like you deliver it in such a way, I feel like it's cool and it's magic and it's lovely to watch.
Well, and that's certainly what makes it professional.
Yeah.
Right? Because the audience will then take it serious if you're taking it serious. Mm. And it is. It's a job. I mean, we're trying to do this for a living. You're paid to do it. And so therefore you take it serious, and that seriousness in the moment that you're in hopefully leads you to that next thing. Because ultimately, nobody is going to be a forever professional improviser. There's going to be very, very few people who do that. It's that next place that it's going to go, so that when you are auditioning for that television show, that film, that movie, when you are finally in a cast or in a writer's room, you have a semblance of what professionalism is and what it takes. Mm-hmm. So you went to Suffolk and 4 years there?
No, I went for 3 years. I had really bad asthma, like all from my junior year of high school through all of college. And it was just super debilitating. And because Suffolk was a private school, when I was in public high school, I could do a 504 plan, which is when the state like writes a letter and it's like, she's missing class, it's because she can't be there. And they had to legally allow me more time and like not count these things against me. But when I went to Suffolk, because it wasn't a state school, they didn't have to do any of that. So it was up to the teachers. And I would still have all my like disability letters, and they'd be like, you missed more than two. And I was like, well, I couldn't breathe. And I got an A on the final. And they're like, well, but you gotta fail because you're absent too much. So I was like, bye.
Petty tyrants. I talk about that all the time. Petty tyrants. I hate them. I can't stand them. And you see that a lot in academia. You see that in places, in nonprofits and stuff like that. You see them like librarians. Oh man, I had a run in. My daughter still talks about it to this day. Like, I think I'm nice. I know a lot of people don't, but I think I'm very nice. You know, like the villain in the movie never thinks they're the villain. They're doing well.
Yeah, they're the hero of their own.
They're trying to change the world for a better place. And the better place for the world will be that everybody does exactly as I say, because I have the best idea, right? That's what makes the villain. I'm not a villain at all. Yeah. So I think I'm very nice. And I hate petty tyrants. And I talk about it all the time. And my daughter still talks about it to this day. We were on our way. This is when she's probably like, I want to say like 10 or 11, something like that. We're on our way, spring vacation, and we're going, you know, I don't know, somewhere, probably going to Florida or whatever. And she had a book that she wanted to read over vacation, right? So like, oh, it's in the library. We'll hit the library on the way up to the airport. So we go, you know, of course, your family, you're rushing, you're running late. So you get to the library about 9:45. The library opens at 10, but they're all there. Right, so you know, I go up to the door. I'm like, you know, knocking the door, and some dude, you know, cracks the door as if like, you know, he's Willy Wonka or something. You know, like I'm like, it's all glass. I see everybody in there. Yeah. The lights are all on. I'm like, hey, my daughter just needs to get this book. She wants to go grab it. We're going away on vacation. And he's like, yeah, we don't open till 10. I'm like, I know, but. I'm literally running late to the airport. She knows right where it is in the shelf. She just wants to. She wants to get a book from a library. We should be applauding that at any moment in life, right? And
do you know how rare this is?
And so,
I need to hold on to
come
this.
Come on. Yeah. And he's like, yeah, we can't open till 10. And that's what I don't have any patience about. Yeah. I'm like, look. I'm like, the kid wants a book. She knows where it is. She needs to get it. This is ridiculous. You guys are all in there. Can you just help me out and let her get the book? Mm. And he's like, well, from an insurance standpoint. And that's where they go wrong. So that's when people start quoting business stuff that they don't know what they're talking about. He's like, we can't let anybody in until 10. I'm like, wrong. That is not how insurance works. Insurance doesn't go on at 10 and off at 11. That's not how insurance works. Insurance is 24-hour. It's for the year. That's when you buy it. I know. I get insured. Can you just let her get the book? And Fine's like, fine, but you're gonna have to talk to the head librarian. I'm like, please give my information to the head librarian. And I hate what you're describing. it doesn't make any sense.
No, it was so frustrating. It just made me, and I was a super nerd all through like elementary school, middle school, high school, and I was just like, you're making me hate school.
Sure.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. So, yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. but just jumping from that to what I think I know about you, but yeah. I could be wrong. So your family owns a restaurant.
We do.
And so tell me about that.
So my grandmother opened a restaurant, Carlene's Coffee Shop.
Say that again, nice and loud.
Carlene's Coffee Shop, Lawrence, Massachusetts, 206 South Broadway. And she opened it, I think, 35 years ago. And then my dad worked there all growing up. And when they owned a bar, he and my mom owned a bar in Lowell. And then when they sold that.
And so just to give listeners an idea, we're talking about Lawrence, we're talking about Lowell. Mm-hmm. These are, you know, to a degree, rough and tumble places
here
in Massachusetts. It's not the Duxbury's of the world.
No, not the Luxbury's of the world.
I worked my way up for the Mills of Grafton, everybody.
They're a little rough around the edges, and my dad bought it and took it over, and he's owned it all my little life, and so I grew up there, and I worked since I was like 11, and I was bussing tables every weekend. And then through high school, everyone would party on the weekends, and I would wake up at 4 and drive in with my mom to open it up because nobody else wants that shift. And mom was like, "You're taking it. It's yours." Yeah. So yeah. And then.
And so that's, I think, where I get much more interested, mm-hmm. right? So you may not at this point in your career and your where you're at be able to put your finger on it. But if you think about it, how has that informed you in terms of what you're doing now mm-hmm. professionally? Any thoughts on that?
Oh, I think that it like gives you such a Rolodex of characters, because you get to see all of these truly crazy people and build this little family of strangers. Because if you come into the restaurant every Sunday and I'm working in the counter, I get to know you, and now I know people for years and years, and so I have this like character log of people. One memory that I love to share is that there used to be an Elvis impersonator who would stand up across the street.
Was that you?
Oh, getting ready for my role of the Picasso de la Pinochet.
Yes. Callback.
Yeah, very nice, very good. That's a callback to previous episodes. Very
good.
All
those devoted listeners will get that.
That's three.
and he would dance rain or shine outside, and he would come in and he wouldn't break character, and he would come to the restaurant, order like Elvis. He used to dance with an umbrella up when it rained, and I loved him so much. He gave me an obsession for Elvis when I was growing up. But just weird people like that are just like surrounding.
Well, I think that's important, and we've talked about this before on previous episodes or whatever. I'm of the opinion mm-hmm. that improvisation as a genre of an art form is number one, overtrained and underperformed.
Yeah.
And then also, because the training center components are such huge parts of all of these businesses, you're getting too centralized a view on people who do improv, and they don't have enough actual life stuff to pull from.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden now, you know, you're asked to do a scene at an office and nobody's ever had a job, and they're like, "I'm gonna make it," and it comes off as fake.
Yeah.
And so to me, having that kind of very real and relevant life experiences, I'm a huge advocate of go do shit and experience real stuff that is not an improv class.
Oh yeah, I think waitressing and doing that kind of stuff is so it's so impactful for a performer, because every time you go to a table, you get to be this new person and try to win them over the course. I loved it. I worked at my parents' restaurant all through college. And then I worked at this place called The Living Room in the North End,
sure.
Which was like such a different feeling. I went from waking up at 6 in the morning to do shifts and then to going to bed at 4 in the morning after a shift.
I hated the morning shift on restaurants. So I worked. Yeah. So I came up as a server, mm-hmm. right? I came up as a waiter. I went to UMass Amherst.
Yeah.
I worked at the top of the campus restaurant. So that was awesome. It was a great job there. Then on the Cape, I worked at restaurants, stuff like that. But one of the restaurants I worked at was a place in Brewster called The Coffee Shop. And it was a morning place. And I am not a morning person.
Oh,
I
yeah.
And I hated every minute. And the tips were always less.
Oh, they're always less.
Oh, and in the Cape, you have a ton of Canadians. And the Canadians don't tip. I can say it. I'm French-Canadian. I can make it so before everybody loses their mind. They're all from Trois-Rivières and mm-hmm. Quebec. But the Canadians don't tip, right?
Yeah.
Because they're like, well, they don't tip. They assume we're being paid a reasonable wage in America. We're yeah. not. Or we're not. So I came up as a server as well.
Oh, yeah. It's morning tips are terrible. We used to open up extra early during the wintertime because plow guys would come in early in the morning and they would just be like, it was like the end of their night and they'd just be so chatty and I'd just be like 15 years old, be like, uh-huh, yeah, very fun. And there's nobody else in the place, so yeah. I have to talk to them. And
so, so beyond character stuff, right?
Yeah.
You know, because I think that you can certainly relate and see that one-to-one on the craft.
Of course.
I would guess that mm-hmm. there's a deeper thing at play, though, in terms of you were young and you were working very hard at something.
Yeah.
Right? And that work ethic, I think that's where I get very interested in our business, because we can always talk about the craft. We can always talk yeah. about how you can find the characters and things of that nature. Nobody seems to want to talk about, or I shouldn't say they want to talk about, they don't always have the opportunity to say, what's the work that has to go into it? How do you have that work ethic? How do you take that, great, you would get up at 4 in the morning with your mom. Well, I would assume, but correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. I don't know. That's that same thing when you've got to write 10 and 20 scripts a week during process, when you have to dig in and get through your rehearsal process into creating a new show, like
yeah.
the work ethic that goes in. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that sometimes people think that because you want to perform and you like comedy that it's not difficult at times and it's not like straining, but it is. I mean, it's very fun and it's exciting, which makes it the work easier to do, but there's that thing where you're just like, if you're not going at it, if you're not like pushing yourself to create new content or to see new content and like be inspired by things, then you're not gonna get anywhere. You're not yeah. gonna create meaningful art.
Well, and the thing is, the fun part, the game, as it were, mm-hmm. is the smallest amount of time within the career, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're on the main stage, you guys are on the main stage, you get more stage time than almost anybody else in this business. Not here in Boston, in the world.
Yeah.
There's only a few comparable or more. It will be Second City on their main stage and their ETC, their resident companies.
Mm-hmm.
The Groundlings maybe, but I would say that you guys get actually more stage time than them because those casts are much bigger, they don't do quite as many shows, and they're more limited in the time that they get on stage.
Yeah.
And maybe Boom Chicago would be comparable in Amsterdam. So you guys get more stage time than almost anybody else in the world in this genre, and it's still a small amount.
Yeah.
So you have to, at least how I always approach it is, you need to love or at least be willing to put in the work on all the other hours.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's easy to do it on stage. I always say that, you know, like, well, of course it's easy to do on stage. They laugh. They tell you how much they love you mm-hmm. afterwards. They can't believe how good you are.
Yeah.
That all feels good. And it's very fleeting.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's not there the next day.
Yeah.
You know?
I feel like there's this, like, inner drive. It's not something that is you should be have to be thinking about. It's just something that should be there and, like, yeah. something you should be wanting to do and needing to do. Like, I'm not like, ugh, gotta go sit down and write. I'm like, I have to write and I have to do this right now. It's not like a yes or a no type yeah. of situation. It's like, no, I need to be making something.
So you said two words that I use all the time. And I'm so happy you said them.
Yes and no.
You're the only one who's ever said those two words. Finally.
He's been waiting so long.
So long. It's very important words. So you said the words need to and have to.
Yeah.
Right? And I talk about this a lot, right? Because I probably even had conversations like this with you guys at some point. But I get newer performers and they ask me about, well, how do we do this or how do I do this? And they will often come to me and say, you know, because I really want to do this. I want to do this. And I always say, well, that's not nearly enough.
Oh, yeah.
Do you need to? Do you have to?
Yeah.
Right? That's the starting point, I think, to move from fun to professional. And I always say, like, do you need to, even in some times where you wish you didn't?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I used to talk to when I was really little, I was like, I want to do this. This is it. This is all I need. And I used to tell my parents that it's like the, like, ambition or like need to do it is like, it's like in your chest. And it's like, it's like overwhelming sometimes, I feel, because I'm just like, it feels similar to this, like your chest gets tight, like your lungs, you know what I mean? You're just like, it's not excited, but you're like, oh, like, I have to be doing it right now, and there's not enough time. You know, it's this weird.
And that's where your asthma came from.
Yeah, that's where my asthma came from. It developed because I was too damn ambitious for this big old world.
You diagnosed with ambition.
Yeah.
Ambition-induced asthma.
What was the, I think it ties into this whole story, but didn't you just the other day have to go, like, your mom's like, get in the Jeep. I need 50 pounds of roast beef.
Oh, yeah. I always have to, she always, like, I have to just do weird stuff like that all the time. Like, go pick up beef and add things to the restaurant, or go drive a toaster to the middle of New Hampshire because there's only one place that'll fix the toaster. And there's just, yeah.
But I feel like that translates because, like, you're like, I'm part of this organism. I have a job. They have a need. I gotta go do that. It's not like I don't want to.
You can't say no to your parents.
Exactly.
And it's like I can't be fired from my family. So like I have to do
it. You can't. But I think to Joey's point, right? And this is where I always get at is that you have an outside life, and if I were to watch where I see mistakes are made or potentially I wouldn't even say mistakes, but pitfalls that I've watched people fall into is they stop having an outside life.
Yeah.
Right? And that could be friends, it could be associates, it could be other experience with your family and business and stuff like that. And I really feel like it's dangerous or not productive for the creative process.
Oh yeah.
Right? And it's very, very dangerous for the psychological aspect of keeping yourself healthy to do this inherently unpredictable and unstable work.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that the fact that you can joke about, we can joke about it, but I'm sure there's something cathartic to go picking up that 20 pounds of meat and getting the hell away from this theater and those people for a while. There's something, I bet you, fulfilling when you're clearing land up in New Hampshire with your father.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that stuff, like you do need to pay attention to that, I think, if you're in this kind of work for the long haul, you know?
Oh, for sure. And I think that there's such like this weird, like lovely moment of hanging out with people outside of the theater, and you just get to be funny in like a silly, goofy way and not funny in like a, well, how is that joke structured? And you're like, well, it wasn't structured. It just was something that I said.
Yeah.
And we can laugh at it and just have a moment.
Yeah. Oh, you're fun. You're fun.
I remember a very specific moment, like in the evolution of my career or where I was at, right? Because we were all, you were probably, you know, very funny amongst your friends. You probably were, right? Same, you know, I know that I was. And then, you know, I started doing this and I started doing this professional. And it was weird because there was a moment where, like, when I went back home to my hometown friends, I was like, oh, this isn't, like, I almost had trouble relating to them humorously anymore because they still joked around on a very certain and basic level.
Yeah.
And mine had evolved so much that I remember for a little bit being like, oh, and then at least I was self enough to go, oh, the issue's me. It's not them.
Yeah.
They're exactly as they're supposed to be. And I remember when I got myself to that place, and then I could almost dial my own self back and say, no, I can joke around again at that level. But I know that there was probably a moment, like 6 months or so, where I probably even felt like I was coming off snobbish or elitist. And I was like, that's me.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you guys have ever felt that in terms of as your career progressed and have to like recalibrate depending on who you're hanging out with.
Well, I always feel like I want to I'm crazy, but I like want to recalibrate for every group that I'm in. So like every, you know, you like feel out a vibe and you're like, oh, this is how we're joking. Like this is how I'm going to move my material for the group of people that I'm around.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, because I just like always, I think that laughter is so honest because you can tell a fake laugh from a mile away. So when you get to make someone genuinely laugh, it's like, oh, I did that. Yeah, like I made that happen. And it's like, it's just great. I love it so much.
It is like being a power. It's a power. It's like being a magician. It's that same thing. You are making somebody involuntarily respond the way you want.
Yeah.
So it's like being, you know, it's a different way of being a mentalist or something like that.
Yeah, that's why I feel like I did like plays and stuff. I never got a part, always ensemble. But I was always like, how do you know? How do you know it's good? Anyone can clap. I can clap for absolutely nothing. You know what I mean? Yeah. But you're like,
we do it all the time. That's how we start the show, right? We tell like, oh, yeah, give yourselves a round of applause. And 200 people applaud, and they're like, wow, this must be good. No, we just told you to applaud.
Yeah.
We've incepted that thing, but all of a sudden you do it. Well, and you know, for me, you know, I started doing improv at UMass, Mission Improvable, and people will ask, like, were you in the theater department, stuff like that? I'm like, oh, absolutely not. I wasn't good enough. I wasn't disciplined enough, smart enough, talented enough. No, that's why I did comedy and improv, because I didn't have the talent for the theater department, so I just make fun of those people.
Yeah.
And yet, what I always loved about improv and ensemble comedy like that was it was that amalgamation of people that maybe had an inkling to do this, but weren't going to be theater kids.
Mm-hmm.
And you could have theater kids in it, and that's what I love about improvisation is, at least when I was doing it, you'd have some theater kids, and you'd have some bro dudes, and you'd have, you know, and you had everything together, and that's, to me, what makes it... I think work on a larger level.
Joey, were you a bro dude?
A bro dude? I don't know. I
think
I got along kind of like what you're saying. I was a member of, like, in high school at least, so many different groups, like sports wise, mm-hmm. but also academically. And then I didn't really get into the theater until I got to the Air Force Academy, which is weird.
Because everybody goes to the Air Force Academy to get involved with
theater. That's exactly. What happens. That's a hot tip.
But it really was, like you're saying, that amalgamation of people who didn't really fit in any other group. And then there was the theater program. So you had a lot of different people. Like our Beauty and the Beast, our Beast was like a lineman. Like he was humongous. And then he sings and you're like, oh my God, you're a god, you know? Mm-hmm. But then we started our improv group there, Fourth Wall. That's a great name, right?
That's so embarrassing for you.
But then we just, it was like a lot of bros and stuff. I'm not a bro. I don't think I'm anything. I'm a Lego maniac.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's a gorgeous,
we don't even put gorgeous labels on anybody here, Joey. You are a retired Air Force captain.
Yeah, there you go.
Who was in Beauty and the Beast.
Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah. What touch was it for? Were you class... clown in high school?
Yes, I was class clown, but it's weird because I people just knew me mostly from sports and stuff, but I was funny in those.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found out that my mom was class clown.
Yeah. Oh, yes, I remember.
I was like, yes. But it's like she, growing up, it was always like my dad was kind of like the funny one, and she was, you know, the very nurturing, loving. And then she's like, look at this. I was like, oh my God, that's where it comes from.
Crazy.
Yeah. I love that.
I really thought you were going to say, it was my mom who nominated
me. I know, I thought that's what he's going to say.
That's what I was like, your mom nominated
My mom came into school, she fixed the whole thing. She wanted me to make friends.
That's fantastic. So, you know, I think when you look at your story and the family business and stuff like that, I think that that does inform you. And coming up like that will serve you so well wherever you're going to go on this, because you do have to figure out it is a job and it is a work ethic, yeah. And it's not always going to be fun. It's not supposed to be fun all the mm-hmm. time, you know. And I think that becomes very important to.
Oh, 100%. I feel like the my parents' place and then my lungs situation. It got like so bad at one point that I couldn't go to school and like I had to go on this medicine that wasn't FDA approved. So when I first had it, so we had to like sign all these papers and I would have to get these shots and stay. Like my body was attacking itself because it thought that I was allergic to everything. And I would get these shots and have to stay at the doctor's because I could have gone into anaphylactic shock. And so I would have to stay at the doctor's for 2 hours after every shot. And I was like 18 and I was just like, well, nothing is as big or like when you're a teenager, you're like, oh, he didn't text me back. Life's over. Everything sucks. But when you're like, oh, absolutely nothing matters as much as you think it matters right now. So you can just calm down, like zoom out from the world and realize that you're so tiny and all these things are so small in comparison to the span of your life and
yeah.
and your impact on everything. Like this is just a day and a month.
The sooner you can get to the point where you recognize that nobody gives a shit about you.
Oh, yeah.
In a good way.
It's freeing.
It's so freeing. Like mm-hmm. when you really realize that nobody gives a shit about you.
Yeah.
We're all tied up in our own stuff. It's like, oh, right.
Oh.
Nobody gives a shit about me.
Anonymity is such a powerful feeling. That is like wonderful. That's why I love talking to strangers. I love doing all, like, because you're like, oh, you don't care even a little bit. I can be whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a wonderful feeling, and that's a moment that I attribute a lot of who I am today.
So I like to think in terms of like, you know, in 10 years, you know, you'll listen to this or, you know, you guys were just in the office when you met Brian Freights. Mm-hmm. And Brian Freights was an original main stage actor here 20 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And so I like to think that in 10 or 15 years, unfortunately, I'm still going to be here and all you guys are going to be like super successful doing really good stuff and I'm just going to be just withering away more and more bitter. Not really. I'm pretty happy.
Say it again!
But for me, you're just going to use the bell like just trying to get me to say it again! Norm, you got to say something. When the bell rings is when you say something.
I can't hear it. Are you ringing it? I can't hear it.
Who's ringing the bell? So, you know, in 15 years' time, when other people here in the office, they're like, oh, my God, I like to think that they're going to see you. And like, that's Aaron Farrington from X. What are any thoughts or goals or hopes where you're going to be in 5 and 10 years from now?
In 5 and 10 years? Well, I don't know. I put a lot of pressure on the future and tend to overplan. So I try to work really hard at what I'm doing now and work really hard at like a next project, make small goals mm-hmm. because if I make too big of plans for the future and then don't get them, I will be very hard on myself. Mm-hmm. So I think for the next like year or so, I have a passion project with my friend Vicky Haynes, and it's Joyce and Edie, and we're writing a new one right now, and I love it, and I'd love to do that in New York with her and take it some places and record it more, but.
Well, maybe we can get that in front of a producer or something.
Oh, I know. Fingers crossed. Can barely take, don't know anybody with that kind of power, you know?
And in terms of that, you know, not necessarily like, I want to be on a TV show
yeah.
or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Where,
that's a dream.
Where do you see yourself, you know, some people are like, well, I really see myself in the writing room or I see myself, mm-hmm. You know, purely performance track. Do you have any, do you give a shit which way it goes or do you have a preference?
I would be happy with anything, but I love writing for myself and writing for people that I know and or respect, and so I like in an ideal world I would write for myself or be have a hand in writing at some projects for myself because I love performing and I think that it's lovely, and you know, I guess got a lot of heart, got all the stories inside my heart, my brain. I gotta share with the whole world. Share with the whole world.
Gotta share the world before the asthma.
Oh, before, you know, yeah, before.
Tightens you up and all of a sudden you just keel right over.
Just die from too much ambition.
How'd she die? She was too ambitious. She was
too not ambitious for this world.
That's like, what's your weakness? Well, I suppose it's my ambition.
Yeah, and they're like, all right, you're definitely not getting the job. All right.
Although Joyce and Edie, Too Much Ambition is a wonderful title.
I love it very much. It's like, it's just an ideal situation.
It's a fantastic show, and I love Vic and those characters.
She's a dream.
So good. And it also cracks me up that the fact that you're probably working in the worst environment for asthma. Unventilated basement in the oldest neighborhood of one of the oldest cities in North America.
Oh yeah, I sit by the little air purifier yells at me. It's my seat. He tries to sit in my seat by the air purifier. I'm like, no.
What's wrong? She's like, I need the air.
My poor little lungs. Yeah.
Well, hopefully you will not keel over and die. But if you did, it would be such a great story for the theater.
Oh, my God. Yeah. You know it's right on my tombstone now, so.
Yeah, that would be really great. Yeah. Well, I hope that in 10 years' time, when you come back here, people are like, we actually have a podcast and a video of that superstar, Aaron Farrington.
Ooh, I love it.
That'd be fun. So, yeah. Aaron, you know that I think you're fantastic. It's so great to see you on stage. So thank you very much for coming on the show. Yeah. And as always, if you leave a comment and you like the podcast, doesn't matter what you say, your comment can be, I hate it. It's still a comment. And if you and that's fine. If you leave any kind of comment, whatever, we will set you up with 2 tickets to a show at Improv Asylum where you can actually come and see the lovely and talented Aaron.
Oh, my goodness. Please say hello.
So awesome. So thank you very much for coming on. Thank you, Joey. So thank you, Ari, as always.
It's wonderful.
Cool. This will be on the norm. We'll talk to you later.